Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Naked Archaeology, exposing the finds.
Hello and welcome to Naked Archaeology with me, Diana O'Carroll.
And me, Tom Birch.
And me, Duncan Howitt Marshall.
This month, building a history of prehistoric Britain.
Round about 3850 BC, some kind of critical mass seems to have been reached because suddenly the Neolithic appears everywhere, bang. Within the next 50 years, it gets from Cheltenham to Aberdeen. Then in around 3800 BC, things really start to rock. It seems like the pioneer phase of Neolithic settlers is over. And what they're trying to do is build a society, because we have so many innovations in the next 100 years, of which enclosures are just the last.
Alex Bayliss there, and she and her team have been working on a chronology for ancient Britain. Duncan.
Plus archaeometallurgy. How do archaeologists actually go about analysing bits of ancient metal found in the soil?
There seems to be, in the region surveyed, both primary production of iron, so production of the metal from its ores, as well as working of this metal, so smithing activities. And why this is interesting is because in the area surveyed there are no known iron ores, which means that ore is being brought to the region and smelted there.
That's Mirto Yurgakopoulou talking about that slag from Kythera. Tom?
In the news this month, how satellites have revealed previously unseen pyramids in Egypt, and how autism might have provided a selective advantage for the Paleolithic human. Plus, in backyard archaeology, I'll be taking a tour of the Aberdeen seafront, looking for a few finds of my own.
Laying the artifacts bare. Naked Archaeology.
First up this month, computer programmers and archaeologists have used a technique known as Bayesian chronological modelling as a window through which to look at the real political and even military events which shaped Britain's prehistoric past. The new research, based on computer-refined radiocarbon dates, strongly suggests that farming lifestyles were introduced from the continent through Kent and Essex by immigrants, and not simply through the transmission of knowledge and ideas. The work also reveals that, for the first 200 years, roughly the first 8 to 10 farming generations, the agricultural revolution spread very slowly, from Kent and Essex in around 4050 BC to the Cotswolds by 3850 BC. On average, that's just over half a mile per year. But after that, the spread travels much faster. Now, to tell us more, here's Alex Bayliss.
Radiocarbon dating, used on its own, has quite large error terms. If you just get a single radiocarbon date, typically in the 4th millennium BC, it will cover about 250 years. But because radiocarbon dates is a probabilistic process, if you get 10 radiocarbon dates for a site, they will scatter around the true date of that site. So some will be a bit earlier and some will be a bit later. And it will look, even if all those dates are from the same Thursday afternoon in 3600 BC, you know, the earliest radiocarbon date will be 250 years earlier, the latest will be 250 years later, and it'll look like that the actual site was in use for 500 years, where in reality it was used for one afternoon. So the basic problem when we started was that normal radiocarbon dates kind of put the early Neolithic of Britain into a kind of splodge. Okay, we know it's early Neolithic, but it's this kind of undifferentiated splodge somewhere in the 4th millennium BC.
Okay, so how do you go about differentiating that splodge then?
So what we do is, instead of just relying on the scientific information, the radiocarbon dating, we've put together both the archaeological information with the radiocarbon dating. Now, I'm the scientist on the team, but I've got colleagues at Cardiff University I work with, Alistair Whittle and Francis Healy, And together, we worked out what that additional information is. So, for example, if you have a sequence of deposits through a ditch and you have three radiocarbon dates, it is very likely from archaeological information that you would know that the sample at the bottom of ditch is earlier than the sample in the middle of the ditch is earlier than the sample at the top of the ditch. And so you can actually use that relative dating that you've got in the archaeological sequence to refine the radiocarbon dates.
Oh, that sounds lovely. But what did you get out once you had this amazing sort of level of refinement?
Okay, well, the project that we actually were working on, the group of monuments we were working on, and this was a joint project funded by English Heritage and the Arts and Humanities Research Council in Britain, was the dating of early Neolithic causewayed enclosures. Enclosures seem to be gathering places that are used periodically. There's evidence for really big feasts where several cattle would be killed all at the same time. And, you know, they had a massive great barbecue, basically. Now, causewayed enclosures are the first big monuments that we have in England. They can be about 300 metres across. They have at least one, sometimes four circuits of ditches. The ditches can be rock cut, but they have lots of different entrance ways, which is why they're called causewayed enclosures. Some of them also have palisades and timber lacings in the earth ramparts that are formed when the spoil from the ditches coming out. So these are fairly big things. You know, you would need several hundred people for a month to build one. So what we did was we went back to the archives in the museum, no new excavation, and we dated all the ones that had holes in from the past. So we've dated about 40 out of the round about 90 that are known, mostly in southern Britain, although there are a few in Ireland and a few currently unexcavated ones further north in England. And we found that they actually covered a very tight span. Previously, these things had been thought to be built throughout the early fourth millennium and to be, you know, typically in use for maybe 300 or 400 years. We actually found that they appear very suddenly round about 3700 BC. And when I say round about, I mean within a generation of within 25 years at 95% probability. They appear first in Kent. Then they spread very rapidly across southern Britain until about 3625 BC. About half of all examples seem to have been built in the first 75 years. So we have a boom. We have a real big construction boom. And that is, of course, followed by a bust, because then there's evidence that for about the next 50 years, it becomes, for whatever reason, they become very unpopular. And then in the generation around 3550 BC, again, it becomes popular again. So we have a boom and a bust and another boom. And then they just go out of use and nobody seems to build them anymore. So there's a final bust.
Right. So if the initial building just occurs in one generation, what are the implications of that then, of that kind of proliferation of building style? What does that mean?
Well, at this point, you kind of, you know, have to get to the stage where, you know, a date is just a number. Because, you know, if you've got no context, you know, we suddenly knew far more about enclosures. But, you know, I can't answer that question without telling you what happened in the rest of the early Neolithic. So we had to kind of unpick the rest of the splodge. OK, so to do that, we just looked at, there's about 1,500 existing dates. So we got details of all of those, looked at all the archaeology and did a model for that. And so we've written basically a completely new story for the early Neolithic in southern Britain. So what happens is, round about 4050 BC, probably the first pioneer settlers arrived from the continent in the Thames Gateway. Okay, then the idea of farming, basically it got from Kent to Cheltenham in about 200 years. Then round about 3850 BC, and by round about, I mean within about 25 years of 3850 BC, some kind of critical mass seems to have been reached, because suddenly the Neolithic appears everywhere, bang. Within the next 50 years, it gets from Cheltenham to Aberdeen. Then in around 3800 BC, things really start to rock. It seems like the pioneer phase of Neolithic settlers is over. And what they're trying to do is build society, because we have so many innovations in the next 100 years, of which enclosures are just the last. But the point is, you've got national exchange networks for high-quality stuff being established. And at the end of this process, this century of real dynamic innovation where really everything is changing, that's when causewayed enclosures appear. So to now to get back to your question, why do causewayed enclosures appear? Well, what's interesting is that both long barriers and causewayed enclosures are typical Neolithic monuments that occur on continental Europe. So the question is not so much why did it appear in 3700, but why didn't it appear in 4050 BC with the initial colonization? You know, this idea was already around on the continent, but they didn't bring it with them. So maybe the idea is that the reason they didn't was because maybe they didn't have the resources to invest in that sort of stuff. They were too busy building their flocks, or they were too busy, you know, setting out their fields. And actually, maybe what we're seeing in the 3700s and with enclosures is an attempt to have control of, you know, what happened at the festival when they had their enclosure meeting. You know, who could get their hands on all this new exotic stuff that was being traded? So maybe it's actually about the emergence of power is perhaps our idea. Now we've emerged from the splodge, there's this story, and we've actually got a dynamic narrative. And because what have I been talking about? I mean, I've been describing a political narrative of southern Britain 5,000 years ago. And we simply couldn't do that before without the dating.
And that was Alex Bayliss from English Heritage. And from this study, it looks like farming was brought in by a specific group or groups of people rather than as a spread of knowledge through indigenous populations. And that marries quite well with a lot of the genetic data. And you can read more about her team's work in the book Gathering Time, Dating the Early Neolithic Enclosures of Southern Britain and Ireland. But now it's time for some ancient news. And Duncan, what have you got for us?
I've got an amazing story this month that combines infrared satellite imagery from space and the discovery of thousands of ancient settlement sites and tombs across Egypt, including two potential pyramids.
What? Space satellites, ancient settlements, pyramids? Duncan, it all sounds like a science fiction film.
Yes, it sounds incredible, doesn't it? Pioneering work by Egyptologist Dr. Sarah Parkak from the University of Alabama at Birmingham in the US is utilizing space technology to search for lost cities and settlements all over Egypt. The search has been ongoing for a year, and the results are absolutely startling.
So what have they actually found?
Well, so far, Dr. Parkak and her team have located more than 1,000 tombs and 3,000 settlements across Egypt, including two suspected pyramids in the area of Saqqara, just south of Cairo. During the pharaonic period, Saqqara served as a vast funerary complex or necropolis for the ancient Egyptian capital at Memphis. The site consists of the famous stepped pyramid at Djoser, which was built in the middle of the 3rd millennium BC.
But where do the space satellites come in?
Well, Dr. Parkak and her team have been analysing infrared images taken from satellites orbiting 700 kilometres above the Earth. The onboard cameras are so powerful they can detect objects less than 1 metre thick on the Earth's surface, so you can zoom in to see very high-resolution images of architectural features and buildings on the ground.
But these ancient sites are presumably buried under vast shifting sands in the Sahara. So how are they able to see all this archaeology?
Well, infrared imaging is a form of electromagnetic radiation. It travels through space in wave-like motion and has numerous applications in astronomy, climatology, meteorology, and even art history. In this case, infrared imaging is being used to detect different materials under the surface of the sand and soil. Now, we know that the ancient Egyptians constructed most of their buildings using mud brick, which is very dense, so the infrared imaging is able to pick out mud brick walls and see the shapes of houses, tombs, and other architectural features across the landscape.
Okay, but there's only one way to find out if what we're seeing is what's actually there, right?
Well, one test excavation at Tanis, a site in the northeastern Nile Delta that silted up in the 6th century AD, revealed a 3,000-year-old house that the satellite imagery had pinpointed. The structure and outline of the building was an almost perfect match, so the technology seems to be working.
Aside from proving that Egypt still has many secrets to reveal, this could save archaeologists lots of time. Could it also be used by archaeologists to target specific areas on bigger sites?
You're absolutely right, Tom. These images are really helping us gain a greater perspective of the sheer extent of sites across the broader landscape. Dr. Parkak said that we are only just getting to grips with the potential uses of this technology in the search for important archaeological sites. In fact, the Egyptian authorities were initially quite sceptical. However, following test excavations based on the findings from the satellite images and the discovery of the two potential pyramids at Saqqara, they're eager to use the technology in the future.
So it could be a really effective tool to monitor and protect the country's antiquities too.
Well, as you know, during the recent revolution, we reported on the looting of antiquities from sites across Egypt. This technology could indeed be used to alert the authorities of looting, as well as inform organisations like Interpol of artefacts that might come up for sale in the burgeoning antiquities markets across the world. So, looters beware.
Yes, looters beware indeed. But now, Tom, what do you have for us this month?
Autism.
You have autism?
Yes, autism, or rather, the autism advantage.
Well, I'm intrigued. Where is this going?
Well, it's really interesting. In May, Jared Razor from the University of California presented a hypothesis in the online journal Evolutionary Psychology about autism, genes, and evolution. Rather than perceiving autism in today's terms as a disability, the paper presents it as a way of life of some of our ancestors. So the idea is that some genes associated with autism were naturally selected and were an adaptive advantage.
It's an advantage for what?
Well, the article, titled Conceptualising the Autism Spectrum in Terms of Natural Selection and Behavioural Ecology, the Solitary Forager Hypothesis, proposes that certain traits associated with autism were advantageous to solitary forager lifestyle. In the ancestral environment, those individuals hunting and foraging mostly by themselves may have developed tendencies that were highly beneficial to survival.
Are those tendencies similar to what we commonly associate with autism today?
Yes, Duncan. For instance, being obsessive, engaging in structured and systemic routines, being repetitive. These tendencies we are familiar with today may have resulted from being hungry and thirsty and alone. These tendencies became focal towards gathering food successfully, finding water, and surviving alone.
Okay, but what about the other traits we associate with autism? So being introverted, being solitary or reclusive?
Well, that's the point, Diana. These adaptive and advantageous tendencies for these individuals were also accompanied evolutionarily with other neurological developments. This solitary lifestyle may provide some interesting insights into the role of natural selection and the autism spectrum. You know, resources were sparse and dispersed. The hunting and foraging strategy in the environment meant that for some solitary individuals, social contact was not necessary for survival.
Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It would mean that some genes related to autism were selected and also maintained because they provided the autism advantage that was beneficial for surviving in solitary environments. These solo hunters and gatherers could be self-sufficient in an environment without human contact, enhancing some abilities such as concentration, memory, spatial awareness, you know. So whilst they have difficulties interacting socially, their other cognitive abilities were fine. Let's move on to one of my favourite subjects, which we've discussed on this show before, slag. Earlier this month, Duncan spoke to Mirto Yokokopoulou about her study on the Greek island of Kythera, where she'd been analysing bits of archaeological metal and slag that could just be picked up from the surface.
Dr. Yorgakopoulou, could you just give us a very brief outline of the early history of metal use in the Mediterranean region? What kind of technology was involved and what kind of items were they making?
Well, for the Aegean region specifically, the earliest metal artifacts that we know of are dated to the late Neolithic, so they're dated to around the 5th millennium BC. These are artifacts mainly of copper, lead, silver, and some gold. Iron appears much later, around the 1st millennium BC. The types of artifacts that have been found are mainly small pieces of jewelry, pendants, pins, bracelets, and we have also found some early simple tools, axes or chisels, for example. Now, here there's an important distinction to be made when we talk about early metals. On the one hand, you have early metal artifacts that are made of metal found as metal in nature, so native metals, while on the other hand, you have metals that have been transformed and are found in nature in their ores, and they are transformed into metal through a range of processes that would go under the umbrella of extractive metallurgical processes. So in these cases, for example, in the first case, you would have copper found as copper metal in nature, while in the second place, you would have copper appearing as malachite in nature, which is a green stone, as you know. And then this, if heated and treated in a specific way, will convert into copper metal. Malachite is actually a compound of copper with other elements. So the kind of processes that we're talking about in extractive metallurgy are mining of the ore and then smelting of this ore into metal, which is a chemical transformation, as I said, from a compound to a metal. And this is a chemical transformation that takes place under very high temperatures, over 1,000 degrees usually. Then you would melt your metal down, the metal you've produced, and work it or refine it, etc.
So what sort of material evidence do these processes leave behind? What kind of artifacts are you actually finding on early sites here in Greece?
Well, luckily for us in archaeometallurgy, these kind of processes leave behind a range of metallurgical materials that are very distinctive and can be studied and give you a lot of information. The most common, and in many ways the most useful material for us, are the metallurgical slags. These are essentially the waste product of the pyrometallurgical stages, so those stages of metal production that involve high temperatures. Smelting, when you convert the ore to metal, for example, produces a lot of slag. But you might also have slag resulting when you melt your metal and work it, which would be refining slag or smithing slag. Other types of materials that we find and we also study are, for example, fragments of ore that were left behind, fragments of metallurgical furnaces or hearths. Early furnaces or hearths were usually lined with ceramic materials, and these survive in the archaeological record and can be recognized as metallurgical. And then you have also implements for blowing air into these furnaces. So bellows, tuyeres, you might have crucibles. All of these materials are termed metallurgical ceramics, and obviously fragments of the metal that was being produced too.
Okay, so talk us through how you go about analyzing the material. How do you treat the samples, and what sorts of things are you looking for? I mean, how do you date them?
Right, well, unfortunately, usually you can't date them directly. You can't date them typologically as you would with ceramics. We will usually base dating on context, so stratigraphic context, and based on other material that is found with the metallurgical remains. You could use very scientific methods, for example, carbon-14 date any charcoal you're finding, or thermoluminescence dating of the metallurgical ceramic fragments themselves. But usually it will be through archaeological context. How we study these materials? First of all, we look at them macroscopically, identify that we have, say, in this assemblage, slags that look like they are copper slags and ores and ceramics. But a very important part of our work involves laboratory work. And for laboratory, we combine all sorts of different techniques. You would use chemical analysis, you would be using optical microscopes, you would be using even more high-tech techniques like lead isotope analysis and things like that. So through various approaches that I've taken to study these materials, I think one of the key conclusions that is coming out of the project is that there is evidence that during the classical period, so the 5th century BC, there seems to be in the region surveyed both primary production of iron, so production of the metal from its ores, as well as working of this metal, so smithing activities. And why this is interesting is because in the area surveyed, there are no known iron ores, which means that ore is being brought to the region and smelted there on very small scales and in various sites across the landscape. At the same period, broadly contemporary, across in the southern Peloponnese, there are large production sites, iron production sites. So you have, in the same period, two contemporary, very different modes of production taking place in a very close geographical area.
Now, you've recently got a new bit of kit here at the Fitch Lab. I understand it's called a wavelength dispersive X-ray fluorescence spectrometer. Bit of a mouthful. What on earth is it and what does it do?
Well, wavelength dispersive XRF is essentially one of a few techniques that are used in archaeology and in material science, not just archaeological science, obviously, to do chemical analysis. What it does is quantitative chemical analysis. Say you have, for example, a sherd. If you analyze it through this machine, it will tell you you have about 60% silicon oxide and 5% calcium oxide and 2% magnesium oxide. And then it will also go down to do trace elements, so things that are then parts per million rather than percentages, small traces of chromium, nickel, etc. And it will quantify these elements for you. So then you end up with a table of chemical data. The next stage is then what do you use? How do you use this data? And this depends on the kind of questions you're interested in. Say ceramic provenance studies. You would try then to group the ceramics that you're analyzing based on the chemical composition. And if you have geological material to compare your data with, then you will try and assign a provenance based on chemical relations. This technique is obviously not restricted to pottery. You can use it for metal, for slags, for rocks, soils, all types of materials like that.
That was Mirto Yurgakopoulou, postdoctoral researcher at the British School at Athens, speaking about the study of slag on the island of Kythra. And you can find more about her work in Archaeometry.
Thanks, Duncan. You're listening to Naked Archaeology from the Naked Scientists. And you can find more episodes like this at thenakedscientists.com/archaeology or on iTunes. Tom.
It's time for Backyard Archaeology, and this month I took a stroll down the river and to the beach in Aberdeen to see what pillboxes could tell me about the potential invasion of the northeast coast. In this month's Backyard Archaeology, I've decided to walk solo along the River Don in Aberdeen, and I'm looking for pillboxes. At the moment, I'm just at the Brig of Don, or the Bridge of Don, which has been here for a long time, historical records suggesting it's been here since the 13th century. Made of wood, now made of stone, and I'm just going to take this mile-long walk along the Don River and see if I can find some pillboxes. Well, I passed the first pillbox earlier on down the River Don, which is at the base of a very steep incline hill-type cliff which protects the Brig of Don. But as we come to the river mouth, I know, awaiting for me around the corner, is another five pillboxes. And we'll just see what they have in store for us. Well, unfortunately, the tide has come in quite a bit, and I've been here a few times before. It's a lovely stretch of coast. We're just north of the River Don now in Aberdeen, along the Balgownie stretch, or the Balgownie coast. And these are the Balgownie pillboxes I can see before me. I'm just stood next to the first one now, which is almost totally submerged in the sand. I can stand on the concrete roof, which is flat. And I've been to a few pillboxes before, but these ones are slightly different. They're not your typical pillboxes. They're, well, sort of hexagonal, but they actually have six sides. So they're irregular hexagonal, as they've been known, sort of five sides in the hexagonal shape facing outwards towards the coast, and the rear being the flat part where the entrance is. I can just make out in the sand here some of the loopholes, and there's some steel which is sort of exposed in the rubblish concrete. So this is reinforced concrete, and it's much more cost effective than having to buy blast armour plating. So this is a cheaper method to make a strong reinforced coastal defence. And I think we have to be careful when calling these things pillboxes, because that's not their actual name. They are coastal defences, some of them further inland at the stop lines. And these defence works, they're called pillboxes because people thought they looked like pillboxes, you know, you keep your little pills in. So anyway, having seen this first one submerged, I'm just going to go up to the third one, which is actually above the sand, and see what differences we can spot. Well, this one is in much better condition than the previous one. I can actually see most of it. I can actually see into the pillbox itself. I was going to crawl in, but I won't now because it's full of rubbish, unfortunately, as is the case. And this pillbox offers us some more insights as to how these things were made. I've read a bit about it, but I didn't think I'd actually see it. If you look on the surface of the concrete, you know, against the light with a careful eye, you can actually make out these lines and impressions of wood, of the grain, effectively. And what you have is the negative impression of the wooden shutters that were used to make these pillboxes. So you'd have this wooden shutter framework which had filled with concrete, effectively, and that's left its mark on the surface of the concrete, which is quite a personal touch, I suppose. You can sort of just imagine it all being erected. Now, what I can see inside this one, which I couldn't in the earlier submerged in the first pillbox, is it just has one large open space. Common to most pillboxes are these internal walls, these blast walls, which are used for protection, essentially. If there's a blast, you can duck behind it and hopefully protect yourself from the main blast. But You can't see here. I know that they're there further up the coast at the fifth one there. You can certainly see them. That these pillboxes are built on top of sewage pipe foundations. They've got five concrete tubes which are stood vertically upright, placed in the sand, upon which a platform is made for the pillbox. So these things can be a lot more sturdy, but obviously over the decades a lot of them have subsided, and the fifth one further up has completely fallen into its foundations. So not on this stretch of coast, Balgownie, but further north at Ramsey Head, I think it's called, the pillbox is almost upturned on its side. So you can really see how these things were made, and we have to put this into context here. You know, 1940 in May, you know, Norway, Denmark, they've fallen to the Germans. The threat of an invasion, a seaborne invasion, along the eastern coast of Britain, in the north, in Scotland, all the way down to the Wash and East Anglia, it was a serious threat. And in order to, well, prepare against this threat, these coastal defence works were put in place. And just to give you a staggering figure of how, well, how much it was perceived to be a threat, 18,000 pillboxes built in 1940 alone around the coast of Britain. And before me are five of those 18,000. It's quite astonishing, really. Now, between the third and fourth pillbox, I can actually make out these sort of pyramid shapes, and some of them have exposed themselves more. But there's these cubes of concrete, just under a metre in size, and it's stuck with them is these jagged rocks. And these are anti-tank blocks to prevent them from moving easily should they land and try and make their way up the beaches. So these anti-tank blocks were a very effective method for preventing tanks from moving in a swift, straight line. And they also had another function, which is not just to be an obstruction to tanks and other vehicles, but should a tank attempt to climb an anti-tank block, which is possible, then two things could happen. One is the jagged, sharp stones, or in other cases, steel, other protruding bits of concrete, would tear up the track. So you could effectively demobilise a tank through these anti-tank blocks. The other thing you could do, actually, is expose the underbelly of the tank. And essentially, the tank would climb the block, and in climbing the block, would have to tip it. It'd have to rise its front, and in rising the front, it would expose the underside of the tank, which is known to be one of the weakest parts of the tank, and therefore vulnerable to being penetrated by anti-tank artillery, fire, what have you. So these anti-tank blocks were not just an obstacle, but they were an obstacle that could be climbed and then could expose the heel of Achilles, so to speak. So very, very interesting strategy. And they've got a lovely name. If you just see one, it's an anti-tank block. But when you see a network of them, and if you stand in line between the pillboxes, they do form a nice line between the pillboxes. This network of anti-tank blocks, they're known as dragon teeth. And it's quite an apt name, really, you know, quite fierce. But this isn't a new concept. We know of similar obstructions that were used in the Iron Age. If you go to Castle Henley in Wales or other Iron Age hill forts, you will see a network of jutting stones sticking out the ground alongside with pit features to present an obstacle. And I think the French for this is chevaux de frise, and it's been common for a long time. So this is not modern technology. This is ancient warfare in the present. So it's quite staggering, really.
And that was Tom interviewing the sea. And that's it for Naked Archaeology this month. But over the coming months, we're looking at some of your backyard archaeology. So if you have something that you found, or perhaps something that's in your backyard, or even a site that's near you, why not take us on a tour? Or perhaps you have some questions that you want us to answer about your bit of archaeology. So just send us a short recording, no more than 20 megabytes in MP3 format. So you can take your laptop with a microphone, make sure it's insured first if you're going somewhere particularly muddy, or perhaps if you've got one of those spangly new smartphones, you'd be able to send us a recording from that. Just email your backyard archaeology to archaeology@thenakedscientists.com. That's it for this month. You've been listening to me, Diana O'Carroll, Tom Birch and Duncan Howitt-Marshall.
Coming to a trench near you, Naked Archaeology. Thank you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.